We're going to be doing a lot of civics tonight. I know you love that. I do. It's one of my favorite areas. And this is Constitution Week, as ordained by the National Congress or State of Arkansas. Somebody legal said we have to teach the Constitution this week. And so we're doing extra projects at the high school, and there's actually a function this coming Monday here at UVIS, a quiz bowl tournament, all based on constitutional history questions, sponsored by the History Department. So if you're good at these things, which you should be from listening to this, we'll be even better after we finish these things, but maybe Monday you might want to get in on a quiz bowl tournament, which I understand the team that wins maybe money, scholarships or computers or something. The quiz bowl's fun anyway, so you want to play. Information to the student union on that. Okay, we're on the thing that says 1783 to 1789, Articles of Confederation. Number one, 13 individual states here. Okay, there's the way to start this off is to look at the word at the, or the initials at the end of number one, which are not mistakenly typed. That was on purpose. A small U and a small S and a capital A is the way the United States of America was abbreviated and signed from 1776 until 1789. So what's the implication here by that? Definitely not a united nation. It was 13 individual nation states. That's how they perceived each other. Individual separate nations who had temporarily allied for defense purposes to be free from Britain. Now they were a little more than just separate 13 nations with no connection, and more than just the heritage of having fought together. They did actually create a form of a national government to unite them together in item two, known as the Articles of Confederation. And they had been led through the war with a common legislature that continued to meet and exist throughout the 1780s, called the Continental Congress. But their form of government was definitely one that was a confederation, and it might be fun here to define these three terms listed in the parentheses: unitary, confederate, and federalist as systems. A unitary form of government, which it used to be easy to say Britain was the best example of, and then they just got crazy in 1996 and based all on the legislature, and that messed up the definitions, but as which they used to have back in like 1700, but before they did that in 1996, messed up our definitions. A unitary form of government like Britain was where all the law and all the sovereignty existed from one central point. So Parliament made all the laws for all of the empire, for all of Britain, and if there is any other local forms of government, they don't initiate law, they just carry out parliamentary law. So one central government only. It's a unitary style of government. That one was clearly the worst model that the colonists, they did not want to follow that model at all. So what they chose instead was a confederate form of government. And we had a confederate form of government twice in history, off from 1777 through 1789, and then again in the South from 1861 to 65. Pretty similar models. A confederate form of government is where there is both a national and state levels of government, but the great, great amount of sovereignty is at the state level. States have all the real lawmaking power. Whatever power does exist, or duties or responsibilities at the national level, is one given by the states, but the states are not in any means or fashion obligated to follow. So it's very much a consensus voluntary arrangement rather than a compulsion. So under the Confederate forms of government, there was no way to force states to comply with what it said. So the Continental Congress really had no compulsion over states. It was just hoping that there would be cooperation. And then the third form of government that is invented in this chapter by Americans, I want to talk about stuff Americans invent, this is one of the best, federalism. Federalism is a form of government where, once again, power is divided between state and national levels, and states still retain a great degree of unique sovereignty, powers, that the national government does not have.
In
some sense, I'm like redefining Confederate form. Two separate levels, state and national. And states still have a great degree of specific powers granted to them that are uniquely theirs. But the national government has many more powers and than it used to have, I guess you could say. And that also, in a conflict, the national government has supremacy over the states. So there's definitely defined powers. States can do this, national can do this. When there is conflict, by automatic given definition, there is federal supremacy to the states, which is the reverse of Confederacy. In Confederacy, it's automatically assumed that states are superior to any voluntary national arrangement. And federalism, and we'll say more about it later, is definitely a unique form that fit the American experience. Now, other countries have followed. Mexico's an example, Germany's an example. There's a number of federated governments in the world, but they followed after the American example. And it's the reason it was welcome was because there was this great degree of suspicion against a centralized authority, suspicion against Parliament, a government too big, too far away, where you have no voice, was what was feared. So as we go through here, I'll be describing some things about the Confederate form of government, which ultimately were weaknesses and failures, and I'll rhetorically ask, why would they make such a government like that? And your answer will always be fear of tyranny. And that'll be the correct answer for those rhetorical questions. Okay, 14. Here's another feature of some significance, and that is, at the Continental, well, I should say it another way, after the acceptance of the Declaration of Independence, where colonies became separate nation states, Jefferson immediately suggested that each state write up a constitution, a chartered document constitution, which defined the powers of the state's government and limited the powers of the state's government. So right away, he's warning, just as the Articles of Confederation format is a limitation on power, so should each state be putting limits on their governments. There's this great suspicion about the fears and the power of government here at work. Most states took their colonial charters and just kind of, through their legislatures, updated those and polished them and made them into state constitutions. Massachusetts was so suspicious of its own legislature being a source of entrenched power, they held a separate constitutional convention. And that would later be the model for our national constitutional convention, based on the same belief that people in the Articles of, what is it, people in the Continental Congress were represented in entrenched power, and so a convention needed to be a fresh blood free from that. So Massachusetts being a model for that. Okay, item 6. Let's look at the powers that were granted to the Continental Congress as a result of the Articles of Confederation. And there will be test questions that ask you to distinguish what powers did the Articles Congress have and what powers did later the Constitution grant Congress, which is what we have today. So there will be a lot of that comparing the two forms of government. What existed under the Articles of Confederation, what was dumped and added in the Constitution. It's kind of like memorizing the rules of a Parcheesi game. I really love this. It's good stuff. Because say, for example, you have a situation where there's like a court that claims you can't do the Pledge of Allegiance and the new judge getting it confirmed, and you want to know all the laws and details of what's going to happen. Here it is. Not that that would happen, but we try to do it. Okay, here are the powers of Congress under the Articles. Well, first let's say this, that each state had an equal vote. So regardless of population, Virginia, much larger than Rhode Island, Virginia still had only one representative in the Articles of Congress, as did Rhode Island. Showing the each state wanting to be protected from larger states that were neighbors. It took two-thirds of a vote for any measure to become law. Even then, we know that's law that's not binding, because they can't force states to comply. And if there was to be any amendments to the powers of the Continental Congress, such as the power to tax or something like that, it took a unanimous vote, which we know is next to impossible to get. Here's what duties and roles the Congress had. First, to conduct war and peace. and draft treaties and alliances. Conduct war and peace and draft treaties and alliances. So foreign military policy and defense policies were to be handled collectively. From the way I defined it, I guess if one particular, two particular states wanted to go off and start their own war or start a conflict with Native Americans, there was nothing to stop them. But this was one of those areas where they saw common cause to work together, so they did. After the lands were acquired from, what treaty, by the way, out here? For the test question that asked you the two different years. 83, yes. 83 ends the Revolution, 63 ends the French and Indian War. So the lands acquired as a result of, so aren't dates cool? Have I given my date speech already?
No.
Okay. I got that flavor. Here we go. So these lands here that were acquired as a result of the Paris Peace Treaty 1783, the residents were Native Americans, and rather than each individual state negotiating with Native Americans collectively, the Continental Congress would do that. So in a sense, they're like treating these people as a foreign nation to deal with. And that will end up kind of being the legal view of Native Americans in the United States for quite some time, that they are kind of like a foreign nation within a nation. In fact, by 1832, the Supreme Court will make that comment, that they have certain specific special rights and lack of rights because they are a nation within a nation. So Continental Congress would deal with that. And also, while we're on this for a second, this may be, I think I'm taking away from what's done in 12, 13 to come up, but a little something that I find kind of interesting is that the new territories, I'm trying to map to show you. I don't think it's in your textbook, it's been in previous textbooks. But you occasionally will see maps. If I keep looking, we'll see. No, it's not going to happen. But occasionally you'll see maps where this area has all these different colored stripes on it, and it'll say claimed by Massachusetts or claimed by Virginia or Georgia. You've seen those before. Each of the states made a claim for the new lands all the way up there. Scott, what page is that on?
269.
Right. 269, if you don't have a book with you now, when you get home and see it, shows those states laying land claims. That could have been the source of conflict. Because if you see in some of, I think that map, I've seen other maps, Maryland didn't have any land claims, but Virginia and Massachusetts had conflicting land claims. So there was the possibility that they could have gone to war with each other over the new lands. So what Jefferson, who was an ambassador to France at this time, suggested by letter to everybody was, why not convince the states to surrender all their land claims between the Appalachians and the Mississippi back to the Continental Congress for two reasons. One would be so they don't kill each other over the land, giving the Continental Congress in a sense jurisdiction over dealing with that land, since it goes in quite in harmony with Native Americans living there. The people you're negotiating with in the lands would all be into the hands of a central authority, Continental Congress. And second, let the Continental Congress sell those lands to settlers to create new territories and states, and the money that is raised could be used to pay off the war debt. And there's double reason for that, not only to prevent bloodshed in the land, but also because we'll see later here in a second that the Continental Congress was not given the authority to tax. So it was hoped that that selling of land would be a way to raise revenues. So that's not listed in here, but it triggered my memory that along with negotiating with Native Americans in the newly acquired lands, they would also eventually have jurisdiction over the lands for sale purposes. Another power, to establish standards of coinage, weights, and measures. So they didn't necessarily mean coin money, it meant to establish how much of a exchange rate money would be, or not, but the medium dollars or pounds for commerce, to try to standardize commerce purposes by having the same currency and same weights and measures. And to maintain a postal service. So from what I listed in item six, what are some traditional governmental powers that didn't get listed? Money powers, for sure. Taxing and regulating trade. And coining money. So those are the things, those three things we're missing. Now someone will say, well, what about the expression not worth the continental? Doesn't that mean that the Continental Congress did print paper money that became worthless? Yes, during the war. But when the war was over, that stopped, and coining money was only done at the state. So coining money, taxing, and regulating trade, like tariffs. So in that respect, if we go back up to the part that says draft treaties and alliances, the only treaties they could draft were military defense treaties, not trade treaties. Trade treaties are trade agreements that dealt with a tariff was left to each state to conduct for itself. So that's where you really get the idea of these separate nations, because each state is able to negotiate with Spain or France or England or whoever a different trade arrangement. And since money is power, that shows us right away where they feared giving a national government the power to tax, the power to regulate trade, retaining that at the state level. There's one of the great, I'd say, defenses to show why the states had the sovereignty, because they had the money power. Now, a problem that will go with that, I've already kind of alluded to, is the United States separately and collectively together, 13 states as well as all of them together, ran up about a $72 million war debt. And to put that in current terms, that's about, I think I looked at an exchange thing, it was like $19 times that makes current time money. There's a thing on the internet called Inflation Index Finder or something like that. Inflation Finder. Where you can just put in any figure at one date and figure how much it's worth at a later date. So if you want to figure out your salary, your house, or your car, et cetera, compared to 20, 30, 40, or I don't know, years ago, that's kind of a fun one. Go to Google and look for it. I think it's Inflation Finder. And I've talked myself into not knowing where I am. War debt. So in order to pay off the $72 million war debt, which could be broken down in a number of different ways, they needed to raise money. And unable to tax, they couldn't do it. So that's one of the reasons they latched on to Jefferson's suggestion of selling the land, which did not raise money near fast enough to pay off the debts. So even after the Constitution's adopted, there's this war debt hanging over the country. Yes, it was. It was finally paid, and here's how it was paid off. They sold, Hamilton came up with this idea, sell bonds, meaning kind of like government bonds, and take the money of the government bonds and pay off the debt. And then they later sold more bonds to pay off those bonds. And it was all finally paid off and retired with a surplus by the 1830s in Jackson's year.
And there were, so the last time you had those extended debts?
Yeah, yeah. And what they did with it, in fact, they had such a surplus of money, they gave it all to the states. States went out and went on a spending spree, causing a runaway inflation and then a depression in 1837, and it's been kind of bad since then. About 1832. Successes. Through the expression of damning with faint praise. Here's the praise of the Continental Congress in the Articles of Federation. Here's the successes. I really should jump to 9 first. Won the war. That's a good one. Gaining independence. I really think that's wouldn't have happened without their unity together through the Articles of Confederation. Back to 8. It set up a system of national citizenship. Meaning if you are, even though these are separate nation states, if you're a citizen of one and you move to another state, you had all the rights of citizenship the minute you moved into another state. That's a feature we still have under the Constitution. Fourth Article of the Constitution defines that. That privileges and immunities of citizens from one state move to another. Which is where you can get into some interesting legal arguments. Today the argument would probably be about whether gay marriage is legal in one state or another, but the one that was much more of a tangible issue, I don't mean to make light of that, but a tangible issue was in both pre-Civil War, well in the pre-Civil War period, if a free African American moved, why they would, knows, but move from a free state to a slave state. Slave states were by law supposed to guarantee the full citizenship of that person. Does it mean that the state government could control the minds and hearts of all its residents, but it was supposed to grant full citizenship. And there were states that made numerous efforts at trying to pass laws saying free blacks could not move into their states, and that was always against the fourth article of the Constitution. So that would become a legal argument as to whether or not, when a given state passed another one of those laws, which they did even much more so after the 1830 Nat Turner Rebellion, because they assumed that free blacks were caused rebellions in the South. But as they passed those laws, were those states to be taken to task legally? Well, they should have been, and they weren't. Then after the Civil War, the argument in the early 20th century became whether or not interracial marriages would be accepted. And that again became back to a marriage, and the record, civil records of one state were supposed to have rights of citizenship be accepted in the next. And certain states had laws against that. I mean, Alabama was one of the last to drop their laws doing so in 1998, finally saying people of different races could marry in their state. 10. 10 I already gave away my punchline. It found a way to settle the newly acquired lands without war through the method that Jefferson proposed, and that was have states all surrender their land claims and let the Continental Congress administer and sell those lands. So that was a success. A little interesting feature, Georgia did not finally surrender all its land until 1803, and there had been some land fraud speculation that took place before that, which becomes a major Supreme Court case because Georgia waited so late to surrender its lands. We'll talk about that later. In this effort to sell the lands and raise revenue, they also proposed a policy that areas west of the Appalachians would go through a period of first becoming territories after they had the minimum number of populations that was 60,000. Is that in there somewhere? Yeah. Once you had a minimum of 60,000 people, your territory could then apply for statehood. It had to draft a would-be constitution and Bill of Rights. I thought that was kind of interesting that each of these new territories become states are expected to have bills of rights. So there's that built into a theory of that government, everywhere we created, is a threat and must be limited as we go. But that they would become states of full equal sovereignty. And this is kind of interesting, is that they'd experienced what it means to be colonies dominated by a faraway government with an unfair voice, and they wanted to make sure the country grew, that each area eventually would be full sovereign states, free from tyranny. Two land ordinances were passed to try to achieve that end, listed in 12 and 13. First one is often called by historians the Township Ordinance, but rarely ever in a textbook is it called that. Really just the land ordinance of 1785. What it proposed to do, and this is kind of building on the notion of the way the middle colonies and northern colonies living and population demography patterns had grown, was to create townships. So that, as I said earlier, the people would move out and start new towns rather than spread sparsely. The belief was, there's a lot of reasons for it, but one of the reasons for this was that you wanted to see orderly population move westward so they're easy to defend and not be in trouble. So they would take these new lands, starting in the Ohio area, for Case Western Reserve. That's one of the first of the areas to be divided off and sold in this fashion, and divided into 6 mile wide square townships. So I can do this by time. So here's what happens. They take land, each, this is 6 mile square, thus 36 square miles. Each individual section of the 36 sections would be a mile square. And a mile square is how many acres?
Like that,
yep, 640 acres, right up a square mile. And so the way the law worked is, if you wanted to buy any of this land, you had to buy a full section. And they wouldn't open up any new townships for sale until every single section was sold. One central section would be set aside, not for sale, but instead for churches, courthouse, schools, etc. So it was kind of considered this would be the community center, and the town would all grow around it. None of the land out further west would be sold until every section was sold. And it would be sold at not less than a dollar an acre at auction price, and it could go more than that. So what's their, from what we've said here, what is their strategy? Yep, go to individual townships, and the way they did it, think about it this way, say that the best sections are going to go for sale first, and at auction price they're going to probably go more than a dollar an acre. So maybe $2 to $3 an acre. We're looking at what? $1,300, $1,500, $1,800 to get any land at all, times that $19 inflation index. Who's going to be buying this land? Merchants, yes. Not the frontiersmen who actually want to live on the land, but some merchant back east who's going to buy the land and then later sell it in smaller amounts for larger price, the individual farmers, land speculation. It purposely was built around encouraging land speculation by the upper elite. Is that a bad thing? Well, try to think of it from a Hamilton perspective. And I know Hamilton's a rat, but don't think about his character. Think about what he proposed, and that is, you want to get your moneyed interests invested and connected to this government's survival. If people with property put a stake into this government, they will not let it fall. If this government falls, if the Articles of Confederation government fails, and chaos ensues, what's going to happen? Could be civil war, could be terrible depression, could be as bad as Britain come save us. You don't want that stuff going on. So you, this government's got to succeed, and you want to get the wealth involved. I mean, I'm a hardcore socialist, but I understand like anybody. You don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. You want that goose to prosper. And so that's what they were thinking here. And it, for the most part, worked. You didn't raise enough money to pay off the war debt in a hurry. But it did work as a system of getting people vested into it, and they sold off lands. The second ordinance, item 13, 1787, also known as the Northwest Ordinance, applied to our pink states here, all the U.S. territory north of the Ohio River and south of the Great Lakes. And it was first going to sell and survey and sell off these lands according to the township proposal, starting one in eastern Ohio. It declared that not less than three nor more than five territories which would evolve into states would come out of this, and five did come out of it. What are the five?
Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan.
And?
Illinois.
So what's the test question? All the following came out of the old Northwest Territory except, pick the imposter state for the answer. Don't say Minnesota. There's some Minnesota here, but that won't be your choice. So again, Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio are the five states that evolved out of the Northwest Territory by this arrangement. Also, and of course they had to have the minimum population in the Constitution, Bill of Rights to become states. Slavery was banned in this area. Again, another proposal by Jefferson, all the way by letter from France. While he continued to own slaves, never freed them while he was alive, he fought continually to try to find a way to end slavery in America. So his suggestion and proposal was, if you ban slavery in this territory, you stop the institution's growth here, trying to hint and suggest that as future land ordinances and acts bring in future lands, you could ban it there too. The real dream of some of these people was to confine slavery to the southern coastal colonies area, and as agriculture that needed diversified workforce moved west, it wouldn't be profitable enough to have slaves. What messed all that up? Yes, cotton gin made cotton more profitable than any other product through slave labor. And the person who invented the cotton gin made it because he hoped it would make life easier for slaves working with cotton rather than for it to grow.
Are these ordinances that are cheaper than money?
Yes, and they got it. So, and you may be wondering, why did the South vote for that? Because as long as it was, they recognized that the trend in the movement of society and politics in the North was anti-slavery anyway, And in many ways, it was agreed upon with the notion that south of the Ohio River, it's not banned and never will be. Again, they too, though, also thinking, how long will this institution even be profitable? So there was some ambiguity there. And of course, what we see here is that what has moved all the way to the Mississippi River now? Mason-Dixon Line. Ultimately, the Mason-Dixon Line will go out over Oklahoma and out to Panhandle, Texas, before the notion of what it means ends. Well, those are the successes of the Articles of Confederation. Everybody looks at the clock and looks at me. Gail, why talk bad about things? We'll do weaknesses and failures when we return.